Welcome to the New Books in Law podcast. My name is Ian Drake, and I'm joined today by Suja A. Thomas, a professor of law at the University of Illinois College of Law, and we're going to be discussing her new book, The Missing American Jury, Restoring the Fundamental Constitutional Role of the Criminal, Civil, and Grand Juries. It's published by Cambridge University Press. And Suja, welcome to New Books in Law podcast.
Thanks for having me.
What I'd like to start off with is for you to comment on what drew you to this topic. Why did you feel a need to write about this at this time?
Sure. I was originally interested in the topic many years ago. I tried a case in New York where I represented a plaintiff in a discrimination suit. And after the jury found for the plaintiff, the jury found certain damages for the person's emotional distress associated with a discrimination and retaliation claim. And I thought that was great, but the judge actually reduced the damages award significantly from over $219,000to $20,000, or we were going to have a new trial. And so I became interested in this topic many years ago, and that is of a shift of authority from juries to other parts of government. And I started to see a lot of patterns where authority of the jury was taken by other parts of government. And that's what led to this book.
So you had your own experience that was negative with the jury system, or not so much the jury system, but really the judge, right?
Yeah. I saw this. I was very surprised to see this, that some other part of government could take the authority of the jury away effectively.
Okay. So your argument, I was struck by the claim you make, and we'll talk about I'm going to mention a few things right now that we can talk about in greater depth, but you make what is essentially, as you describe it yourself, an originalist argument, wherein, for the benefit of our listeners, originalism is essentially the interpretation of a statute or constitution according to the meaning that it had at the time that it was enacted, the popular meaning of the terms used in the statute or constitutional provision. There are different strands of originalism, but that seems to be the one that you're embracing in this book. Is that right?
Yeah, that's right.
And so your argument is an intriguing one, where you argue that essentially the founders, they did not simply envision three branches of government, but essentially a fourth branch. And so can you expand upon that?
Sure. In the book, I really try to make the argument that the jury serves as the role of a branch of government, just like the executive, the legislature, and the judiciary. And that is that when the founders talked about the jury, they talked about it in the same types of terms that they talked about the executive, legislature, and the judiciary, and even the states. And that is that the jury was a protection against other parts of government. As a result of finding this information about how the founders talked about the jury, and also if you look at the text of the Constitution, the jury is actually very similar to other parts of government, and that is that the constitutional text empowers the jury to decide certain types of cases. So that's the reason why I argue that we really should be treating the jury just like another branch of government.
Now, one of the concerns that I had, and this may seem very simplistic. First three articles deal with three different branches. Why do they not then perhaps create a separate article for the juries per se?
Well, in Article 3, they actually mention both the judiciary and the jury. And so you could say that Article 3 is shared by the judiciary and the jury. And so that's the criminal jury. That's in Article 3, Section 2. So that's one argument. And then the second part of this is that post the original Constitution being enacted, the Seventh Amendment provides for the civil jury and the Fifth Amendment provides for the grand jury. And so they get their own provisions in the Constitution. It's just in the Bill of Rights. So I actually think that if you look at this text, the actual text and what it states, It similarly provides for the jury to have authority or power, just like it provides that the executive has certain authority and the legislature has certain authority and the states have certain authority and the judiciary has certain authority.
And so when the framers of the Constitution are drafting Article 3 and they're thinking about the jury function, is it right to assume that they were not so much thinking about how the individual state juries were going to function, but rather juries only in federal court?
That's a difficult question because there is some indication when the ratifiers of the 14th Amendment talk about the 14th Amendment, and that is whether or not certain provisions of the Bill of Rights should apply to the states, that there was some indication that there was already a belief that certain parts of the Bill of Rights actually apply to the states. I think it's a difficult it's a difficult argument to sort of pinpoint.
So is the is this partly a historical concern for an originalist approach? Meaning, is there enough evidence historically for us to be able to confidently conclude that what the framers wanted was a very powerful jury? And in the book, of course, what you do is you go into you take an historical investigation of different terms used in terms of common law and other terms that were used in 1791 with the Seventh Amendment and in 1787 with Article III. Is there sufficient evidence to know really what the original intention was, and then the original meaning would have followed on with that? But do we really know then what they were historically thinking at the time they drafted this in terms of what kind of juries they would be dealing with?
Yeah, I think that is right, because the historical basis of the jury in the United States was this incredibly vibrant English jury. And that jury was such that, you know, you had grand juries deciding whether serious cases should proceed. You had juries decided whether defendants were guilty of crimes. And you had juries deciding whether monetary damages or fines should be awarded. And we based our jury on that English system. And so there's plenty of evidence that that's what we based our system on. And then you have the provisions of the Constitution itself that provide for vibrant jury authority. And then if you look back, which is what the Supreme Court does, right? The Supreme Court looks back and looks at our history and has looked at English history to interpret lots of provisions of the Constitution and sometimes the provisions of the jury provisions. So I do think that there's significant evidence that supports the jury having vibrant power that's based on the English jury. And I can talk more about, you know, specific procedures like that. We didn't have procedures like summary judgment in civil cases. We didn't have plea bargaining.
And I want to get into that in a little bit in terms of what comes along later historically. But let's stick with the 18th century for a few minutes in terms of what is the role of the jury, whether it's at the colonial, provincial level, or even in London itself. In other words, how active is the jury? What do they do beyond simply deciding the facts of a case?
Yeah, the role of the jury was significantly to check the government. That was one very, very important role for the jury. And so you would have sedition cases where people were prosecuted for speaking out against the government, and juries would refuse to indict or convict in those types of cases. So one really important function was to check the government. I think that because of the fact that juries decide very few cases now, has been taken away. And then outside of that, the English, and then we followed, we just decided that the jury should be the body that decides disputes between people where monetary damages are awarded. And so we delegated that to bodies of people to decide. And I think that makes a lot of sense that the community gets involved in those types of decisions.
And was there general agreement on all sides that this is really the role that the jury should take, or was there a decline from the beginning in terms of the jury's fortune in the American context?
It's hard to, if you're talking about the statistics, it's hard to pinpoint exactly when the decline of the jury occurred. There are some statistics that show that plea bargaining, for example, occurred only in around 20% of the cases at the beginning of the 19th century. And then that increased, you could argue, to around 90% at the beginning of the 19th century. And that's in the criminal context, and those figures aren't exact. It's hard to exactly say when anything in particular occurred, because statistics are not readily available, you know, until kind of the mid 20th century. So if you're talking about statistics, it's difficult to actually say exactly what is happening at what point in time, although I try to do some analysis in the book.
And statistics are even tough to come by today sometimes, right, with modern.
Although we're doing more and more of them. But I think I haven't even mentioned those statistics yet. But, you know, right now we have less than 1% of civil cases decided by juries where those cases are filed in federal and state court. And in criminal cases, only 1-4% of cases filed in federal and state court are decided by juries. And then in many states, we don't even have grand juries.
So you make the argument that the jury is an integral part of the political system. In other words, it's more than just something of a co-equal or a symbiotic relationship between the judge and the jury. It's actually beyond just the judiciary as an institution. It reaches into action by the executive and even the legislative branches. Can you expand upon that a little bit?
Sure. So the jury can check the executive by the fact that if someone chooses to, for example, prosecute a case, that the jury can decide, you know, no, that person shouldn't have been prosecuted. The jury can check the legislature by the fact that the legislature makes something a law, for example, the sedition laws, and say, you know, no, someone shouldn't be convicted because of that. The jury can check the executive where there's a civil case brought against someone who the police who come into someone's home, and the jury can decide whether or not someone should actually receive damages because a person came into someone's home. So there's a lot of ways that the jury can check the government, and as a result is an integral part of government.
So some of the evidence that you use to note the active work of the jury and its protection is Supreme Court decisions in the 19th and early 20th century. And you charted out at one point where you note that around the latter half, but especially near the end of the 19th century, there are several Supreme Court cases that uphold the power of the jury and challenge attempts by the judges to take certain functions away from the jury. And it seems to me that that would suggest then that there needs to be some quote-unquote policing that's done by the court on behalf of the jury. So post-Civil War, perhaps, this is when we start to see the beginnings of the judiciary itself trying to take over functions from the jury. Is that really when you are concluding that it must be beginning, because we start to see these Supreme Court cases that actively defend the jury?
So Yeah, that's an interesting. It's an interesting point. The main point that I try to make in the book is that I know that we see these anti-Supreme Court decisions on the jury beginning in the 1930 and going forward. And so it's an interesting point that you're making that earlier than that the court had to kind of defend the jury's authority, and that there were these active ways to that were attacking the jury's authority. I actually haven't, thought about it that way. And I've been more thinking about it in terms of that the court decided certain cases where it was pro-jury, decided issues that favored jury authority. And then later, as you know, from the book, that later the court actually decided the same issue against jury authority. But you make an interesting point about why the court was getting involved in those circumstances, and that maybe, in fact, at that point in time, the court was becoming a defender. But then, as my book tells the story, it certainly later is not a defender.
That's right. The point you make in regard to these decisions is that at one point the Supreme Court essentially defended the jury in the 1890s, roughly, and by the 1930s and thereafter, you get this erosion of jury power. Now, let's give a couple of examples of what's going on here. So what is it that now the judges are doing that juries previously handled?
Sure. So I think one of the examples I like to give, a criminal example, which is in 1898, the Supreme Court said that a criminal defendant could not waive the trial of 12 jurors. But then on that same issue in 1930, the Supreme Court said, yes, a criminal defendant can waive the trial of jurors. And in fact, a judge can decide instead of a jury, even though Article 3, Section 2 specifically states a jury should decide. And then in 1970, the Supreme Court actually said that you don't even have to have 12 jurors. And so that's an example of in the criminal context where the court makes a decision in favor of jury authority, but then turns around and decides two decisions on the exact same issue and goes against what it decided in the past. And then the civil example that I like to give is that the Supreme Court considered a case where in a civil case, once a jury found for, let's say, Jane, that if the judge thought the evidence was insufficient, and that is that the jury should not have found for Jane, that the judge could not find for the other party, let's say that's Ken, the judge could order a new trial. But the judge could not find for Kent. And then just over 20 years later, the Supreme Court just totally, completely switched and changed its mind and said that once in a civil case, once a jury finds for Jane, if the judge thinks the jury was wrong, the judge can find for the other party, Kent. That's it. And so one of the things that I say in the book is that in many contexts, I think that the jury has become an advisory jury. That's how we really need to think about our jury in the United States right now.
And so historically, what do you think are the causes of this? You offer up several possible causes, and sometimes they're even expressly referred to by the courts themselves, or at least by commentators, even if they're not sitting on the bench. So what are some of the causes that you think led to this shift in the jury's power?
Sure. So one of the things I think I have to point out, and I kind of point out in the book, that the jury is actually really different than these other parts of government. The jury can't protect its own authority. It has certain characteristics. Obviously, it has to actually be constituted so the executive can act and prosecute or pardon. The legislature can make laws. The judiciary can act. The states can act. But the jury actually has to be constituted. And so that's part of the story, I think, that the jury is this sort of passive actor that actually has to be put in place. But one of the things I point out is that the characteristics of the jury that are different than these other parts of government, that's always been the case. The jury's always had those characteristics. And as we talked about, the jury has sometimes been held to have authority. So what I point out is that the Supreme Court itself has talked about the jury in different terms than the Supreme Court has talked about the what I call the traditional actors of the executive, the legislature, the judiciary, and the states. And that is, the Supreme Court has used doctrine to protect the power of those parts of government. It's used separation of powers to protect the executive, the legislature, and the judiciary. It's used federalism to protect the federal government versus the states. That is, it uses these doctrines to protect each of these parts of government and to limit each of these parts of government. But the court, even though the founders talked about the jury very similarly to how the founders talked about these other parts of government, the court has never created doctrine to actually protect the authority of the jury. And so that's one thing I think that's really happening here. As you know from the book, what I do is I try to look at this period of time where authority starts to shift away from juries in those cases that I mentioned before. There are several examples of the court deciding in favor of jury authority and then deciding against jury authority. And so I tried to actually look at New York Times articles to try to figure out what was going on. And I looked at New York Times articles because scholars have talked about that the Supreme Court potentially can be influenced by or follow public opinion. And so I looked at New York Times articles because that could indicate public opinion. And people have also written, scholars have written that the Supreme Court may follow or be influenced by elite public opinion, and the New York Times could potentially indicate that. So I looked for the term juries in a period of time that started with the time that the New York Times started to the time that I see this pattern starting where the Supreme Court starts deciding against jury authority. And I found some hints for what's going on, including judges speaking against juries and talking about how juries aren't as good as judges. So you even have a justice of the Supreme Court who had formerly served on the Supreme Court, later served on the Supreme Court, and also was the president of the American Bar Association in the past, saying that, you know, we're better than juries and we should decide. And another judge similarly saying something. So I think that is some indication. And of course, I talk more in the book about other things that are stated and what other scholars have also said about this period of time. But I think judges saying that we're better than juries is an indication that judges are finding for themselves, that is, that they should have authority, and also finding that other parts of government should have authority and that it's okay for the jury's authority to shift to these other parts of government.
So it seems that we're left with one of the foxes guarding the hen house, right? In the form of the judiciary having to take action on its own in order to protect the jury, whether it's a traditional function or the newly emergent function. And I was struck by this. Now, you didn't go into this in detail, but I am curious about what you think about this. This happens, this protection of the jury in the 1890s and this change over the course of the 20th century where the jury is really greatly diminished, is a period of the technocrat wherein the person who's an expert is seen as the ideal functionary in the government. This is part of the rise of the administrative state, that they have the knowledge and the skill that's best suited to good governance, and that really you solve all your problems by just getting an expert in there. Do you think that that disposition is something that may influence this shift on the part of judges, saying that really judges are the best to do this, if we do say so ourselves?
Yeah, I think that is certainly part of the story. And I think others have written about, as you know, have written about the rise of the administrative state and the influence of that. And I think that you're onto something, that that judges definitely think that they are better able to decide these types of issues. I think that they think that agencies, as a part of the administrative state, are better able to decide these issues. The example that I like to give is this more recent example where the SEC has started to shift civil insider trading cases to itself to decide, even though in the past juries decided those cases. And wow, that's pretty astounding, I think, where the government is accusing someone of insider trading, and then Congress states to the SEC, you can decide this yourself. And certainly the argument is that we're more efficient and we're better able to decide the case. But as you know, the problem becomes, especially in a situation like that, that someone that's doing the accusing is also doing the deciding. And I think that's hugely problematic. But I do think that you've pinpointed something that's very important here. And it goes back to some of the quotes that I have in the book, that these bodies think they are better than the jury.
So let's jump ahead here. Right near the end of the book, you make an argument for how to, quote-unquote, reform this. And you give what you call suggestions. Can you outline those? And then I want to ask you a few questions about those.
Sure. So the main argument that I make is that we actually should get rid of procedures that have eliminated the jury's authority. And that's based on the historical model of the English jury. And so I talk about the fact that we have procedures like summary judgment that didn't exist in England in the late 18th century. We have administrative agencies deciding issues that didn't have the authority to do that because, of course, they weren't created and they were not part of the Constitution. I talk about the fact that the Fifth Amendment should be applied to the states. And I also talk about judicial acquittal. That is, judicial acquittal didn't exist. That is, once a jury convicted, a judge could not decide that the jury should not have convicted. So my first argument is that these procedures that have been created by the legislature and the judiciary should not be permitted to be used because they're, in fact, unconstitutional using originalism. And in fact, I just wanted to sort of say that the reason we need to use originalism is because the jury otherwise won't have authority. We have a grasp for power from these other parts of government. And so we have to actually be tied to a set point in time as to what the jury actually looked like. And so that's part of, that's my main argument in the book. But what I recognize is that in this time, it's unlikely that Congress is going to decide that any of these procedures, and those are just some examples of procedures that I think are problematic, that Congress will say no to those procedures. And it's also very much unlikely that the United States Supreme Court is going to find any of those procedures unconstitutional, again, though, despite the fact that I think there is significant historical reason to find them and textual reasons to find those procedures that are eliminating the jury unconstitutional. So in the brief last chapter, I outlined some ideas for changing the system as sort of intermediate proposals for change. And so is that what you would you like me to talk about?
Sure.
Those?
Yes.
Yeah. And so I've actually changed a little bit of my thinking, actually, even since I've written the book. And so what I want to talk about is I'll talk about three of them, and that is the plea offer requirement, the sentence requirement, and the consensus requirement. So the plea offer requirement and the sentence requirement are an effort to alleviate plea bargaining, and alleviate the problems of plea bargaining. So the problem I see with plea bargaining, and as I said before, it happens in over 90% of our cases. The problem that I see it with plea bargaining is that you have this disparity between what's offered to the criminal defendant at plea, that is the sentence that's available at the plea, versus the sentence that's available at the jury trial. So in essence, by taking your jury, you're having this penalty associated with taking the jury. And so as a result of that, the jury decides very few criminal cases, and most cases are plea bargain. So what I do with my plea offer requirement and my sentence requirement is I propose that, in fact, the plea should be an active part of the jury trial. And the way that would be the case is, let's say someone was, there was a case where a prosecutor was saying to a criminal defendant, take a plea offer of simple possession. If you take that plea, you're going to receive this particular sentence. But if you choose to go to a jury trial, I'm going to try the charge of possession with intent to distribute, which, of course, has a much higher sentence. And so if the prosecutor offered that, what would happen is that at the actual trial, if the criminal defendant didn't take that plea offer of the simple possession, the jury would actually hear and be able to decide itself whether to convict on simple possession or the possession with intent to distribute or nothing. And the jury would actually hear the sentences associated with each. And so the idea here is that the jury is actually going to be able to convict on what was actually offered at the plea. And I think that actually is fair. And it allows the criminal defendant to actually take the jury because you can actually receive the sentence that's associated with the plea. So that's the plea offer and sentence.
Okay, so you have this proposal that it seems to me is going to respect the jury's capacity for making judgments that right now, today in modern practice throughout America, at the state and federal levels, is a function of the prosecutor. And so this will grant the jury a lot more effective power in the criminal justice system. And let's assume for a second that that's an admirable goal. In other words, I won't challenge you on the wisdom of that, but how is that politically possible in terms of being realized? Because it seems to me that as, back in Federalist 51, famously, Madison argues that ambition will be checked by ambition, but there's no permanent juror. It's an ad hoc institution, right? In other words, there's nobody that occupies that public office that's there to advocate for it. And so how is this a project that's politically possible today? And I don't mean just in the sense of whether people like the idea of giving the jury versus the prosecutor more power. And I suspect many would. That's just my armchair suspicion. But how is it something that would be achieved? Because as you've already noted, it's unlikely that the judiciary is going to step in and say, well, you're right. We've been looking at it wrong all these years. Let's go to the originalist approach. Even a lot of purported originalists might be fearful of the consequences of taking power away from the judiciary. So how then is this a project that's something that could be realized in practice?
I think the way this could be realized is that, similar to how we're having sort of a public consciousness of mass incarceration and people thinking, okay, this is problematic, and we similarly are starting to think about mandatory minimums and whether or not those are appropriate. So I think that we've had issues that are actually related to some of the problems that I think are associated with the jury not having power. And so plea bargaining just hasn't kind of been the focus yet. And so I think that because of the sort of appreciation of the problems with mass incarceration and the problems with mandatory minimums, that I actually think politically that we're actually we're there. And we're also concerned about innocence. We're concerned that innocent people are pleading guilty. And, you know, but even separate from innocence, I think that we have concern that people who are poor, people who are, you know, sort of disenfranchised in our system, don't have a lot of power. And as a result, they're the ones that are being forced to take these pleas. So I think that because of these other sort of movements, I think that there is real good possibility that this can be a movement. And I'm certainly trying to, through the book and through actually writing more about these proposals, trying to bring attention to these issues.
And there is one chapter that you have where you review the state of jury practice in other countries. Why did you include that? What was your objective in that? In light of the fact that much of the book is really about the American context and American constitutional interpretive context, what is the aid that is brought to bear by referencing all these different countries?
Sure. The reason I did that was I wanted to look in that particular chapter at going beyond history. So most of the book is, you know, historically we were supposed to have a vibrant jury and this is what the jury was supposed to look like. But I recognize that a lot of people think that history has a limited role in interpreting the Constitution. And I wanted to look at why the jury should decide otherwise, or why the jury should not decide otherwise. And so I looked at sort of the qualities of the jury. But I also looked at what other countries were doing. And what we see is that there are a lot of places that are considering lay participation, either in as a part of a mixed panel that is of judges and jurors, or simply like what we have in the United States, a pure jury where we have all lay participation. And so there are a number of places that are newly considering lay participation. There are a lot of other places in the world that have lay participation. And in some ways, while we have supposedly a jury available in many more cases than in other places, you can actually argue that in the United States, because a judge can almost invariably second guess a jury, that in some other countries actually don't have that system. And so you could argue that the jury or lay participation in other countries, in some other countries, is more vibrant than in the United States. So I wanted to make these points so that people can understand that, you know, you could actually look to other countries and sort of say, you know, our lay participation isn't necessarily the greatest, if you compare it to other places in the world.
And we're almost out of time here, so I want to just ask you about one of the objections that you note that seems to run throughout the entire 20th century when the jury's starting to lose some of its power, is that we've got so many cases in the system, whether it's civil or criminal, that simply there's not enough days and hours in the week to try everything. And certainly, you know, juries themselves are notorious for 5 o'clock Friday afternoon, if that's when they're deliberating, all of a sudden they magically come back and have a decision because they don't want to come back Monday morning. And so the concerns about efficiency and cost, those seem to be, I think, truly pragmatic concerns. And what do you think the best argument is against, you know, both the judges and the jurors themselves, who would say, my goodness, this would take an even larger judiciary to handle all that's out there to be heard in terms of trials.
Sure. So I just want to make one point just about jurors. What judges always say about jurors is they do a really good job. So so that's always something that I always like to mention. And people also say that jurors, and you didn't say this, but sometimes jurors don't want to serve. But once they actually serve, they actually really, really appreciate their experience. It's like something that they talk about and that they're happy to have done. Of course, there are going to be exceptions to that. So I just wanted to mention that while we were talking about jurors. But in terms of what you're saying about the efficiency and the cost and the argument about that, so the jury was never meant to be, efficient or necessarily a small cost. The jury was meant to be a part of our Constitution. And, one of the things I like to say is that these other parts of government actually can be incredibly inefficient. So the legislature is obviously one big example of that. But even though the legislature is inefficient, we don't say let's get rid of the legislature and give its responsibility to some other part of government. And I think that we have to think about the jury in that way, is that the jury is a part of our Constitution. We gave it certain responsibilities. It was never meant to be efficient. And while we can do things to try to make our system more efficient, and I think that we should do that, I think that the efficiency cost argument is something that we don't use for the other parts of government, and we shouldn't use for what I call the other branch, the jury.
The book is The Missing American Jury: Restoring the Fundamental Constitutional Role of the Criminal, Civil, and Grand Juries. And we've been joined today by its author, Suja A. Thomas. It's published by Cambridge University Press. Suja, thank you so much for joining us on New Books in Law podcast.